Hello, Eric.
This is Eric Stewart.
Hey, Eric, how you doing? This is Jermaine.
Hey, Jermaine, how are you?
I'm doing great. Right, so we'll give it about another 30 seconds, and then I'll do a quick introduction, okay?
Sure, sounds good.
So how are things going?
Everything's going really well. Can't complain a bit. Real busy, and just I can't believe the year's flying by. It's April already. Halfway through April. So, how about you?
Everything's going well. Can't complain. Like I said, the only thing that, I know you're in Florida, right?
Some of the time, I also have a place in Illinois.
Oh, okay. So you know it's been cold in the Midwest and in the Northeast, so.
It snowed yesterday. It's very strange.
All right.
So,
All
I
right,
was
so
just
we
going to do kind of a market overview too. I didn't know if
Yep, whatever you want to do, Eric, that's up to you, okay?
Okay.
But we do have some questions from some people who email some questions, so if we don't have any questions on the line, then we'll take those questions, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, so let's get started. So good afternoon, everyone. This is Jermaine here, and just wanted to let you guys know that today we have a very special guest. We have Eric Stewart from Atlantic Business Capital. Now, everyone may know Eric from the Multifamily Millions Boot Camps, the Ultimate Partnering events that he goes to. Eric also does the he's the funding specialist for the certification program, so you've probably seen him on those certification programs. Does an awesome job. But we're lucky because today, for any mentorship student, we have him exclusively just for you. So if you have any questions in regards to funding, Eric's definitely the guy. So if you have questions about mortgages, sponsorship, bridge loans, assumption mortgages, well, Eric's the guy you want to talk to. So without further ado, here's Eric Stewart.
Hey, thanks, Jermaine. I appreciate that. Thanks for letting me chat with everybody here today. As Jermaine said, my name's Eric Stewart. My company's Atlantic Business Capital, and I've probably met with a healthy amount of you on one occasion or another. And today, what I was going to do is just give a market overview, how things are going here after we've kind of put to bed the first quarter of 2018. Let you know what I'm seeing in both the debt markets, the equities market, and then also touch on any questions that you might have, or any questions that think I can answer. Please feel free to let Jermaine know, and we'll be happy to address as many of those as possible. So just to start off with, Atlantic, in addition to originating new purchase money or new mortgages, we also offer assumption representation, and we've been doing more and more equity structure as well. Also sponsorship from time to time for the right deal. So please feel free to give me a call as things come up, and I'll help any way that I can. Talking about the current lending market and what we're seeing out there. Once again, we started off 2018 with solid momentum. Real healthy volume, and we've also seen as the health of the market increases and it continues to rise, we're also seeing a rise in the 10-year Treasury and a rise in rates. So, starting off the year, we were closer to the 2.5 point on the 10-year Treasury. We were closer to the 2.5% yield. We're up 2.85, 2.83 right now. So that puts our interest rates on, let's say, anywhere from 10 to 15-year fixed rates, right in the high fours to low fives, depending on what the specifics are of that project. And a lot of times we've seen some reduced rates by some special programs that our lenders are offering. There's some green initiative programs out there that you might be able to see a reduced interest rate with. And there's also, which is obviously some environmental, water and electrical usage conservation programs. And then there's also some discounts that we can get based on the affordability of the property and what the average income of the tenant base is, what the market rents are or the property rents are relative to the market, things like that. So as we see our markets increase and cap rates compress, we've seen this for years now. The institutions are going further and further out into secondary and tertiary markets to try and find that yield. So it just gets more and more competitive as we go, which is just, means we just need to educate ourselves and prepare that much better to find those deals and build those relationships. I've also seen an increase in rehab deals, people that are trying to create that value. And I'm sure everybody else, as you look at OMs, you put your LOIs out there, you're scratching your heads on how you can increase the production of the property and get those returns for your investors. There's more and more value add coming into the market, at least that's what I'm seeing. So that's kind of the current state. As far as rates going forward, we're still seeing the general consensus that we're going to be in a rising interest rate environment. I don't see any reports really that are talking about rates pulling back. There's always that small report that's a doomsday report, but in general, the general consensus is that we're going to continue to see rising interest rates. And a hedging strategy for that, I see two of them. Obviously, the basic one on your perm deals is that you're just going to fix your interest rate for a longer period of time. Based on the way these loans are structuring, I'm seeing more and more 12 and 15-year fixed periods, and I've got a specific reason why I've recommended that. It's more attractive for your exit strategy and that facilitates an assumption a little bit better when you leave a potential buyer with a longer runway. And I'm also seeing rates being really, really competitive in that range. So longer fixed rates are one way that we're hedging against rising rates. And then let's say you're doing a bridge deal, a shorter term hold or some type of unstabilized property where you're going to have to refinance. If you want to hold it, you're going to have to refinance into the market in a couple years. That's really when you have to focus on forced appreciation. And you're really looking to create the value through unit improvements or bringing units back online or whatever the case may be. But forced appreciation, rather than just waiting for the market to run up and increase the valuation or the income of the property, you're actually getting in there and rolling up your sleeves and making it happen. Those are the two strategies that I see going forward as far as being able to refi and protect your exit. And that's really a common strategy that lenders are looking at as well, is when you're taking these bridge loans, not only are they looking at the current property performance and what kind of debt service and debt yield the property currently has, but they also look at your leverage based on the stabilized value. And they pay close attention to that relative to where perm debt is right now, or perm debt is when you originate the loan. So let's say you're going into a market, a smaller market that maybe has a current cap with Fannie Mae at 65% or general cap at 75%. Well, that lender is going to look at your stabilized valuation and really not want to lend more than 65 to 75% of your stabilized value. And this is going to protect you as well, because the last thing you want is to be over-leveraged when you're trying to refinance and possibly have to come to the table with more equity. So just keep that in mind as a qualifier when you're doing those bridge loans. It's quite common, and we all know that we want to keep our funds as our cost of funds as low as possible. So, these bridge lenders are out there anywhere from, 1% origination and 6% interest only to 5% origination and 12 to 14% pay rate. So they really do range. But nonetheless, your leverage is super important as far as relative to what that stabilized price is and what you're going to be able to refinance out. So just keep that in mind when you're structuring your rehab deals and your bridge debt. You know, we talked about bridge lenders, so going into a little bit more about who's lending. You know, Fannie and Freddie are still the dominant lenders for multifamily. They're still the ones that are putting the most attractive pricing out there. You know, conduit lenders are certainly still a viable source of debt. We use those a lot of times when there's, let's say, a specialty tenant base. Maybe it's student. Maybe it's you know, some type of specialized housing, affordable housing, something like that, where maybe my borrower doesn't have the previous experience that one of these agency lenders is looking for. You know, it's real common that we can leverage a conduit lender in a case like that, where they'll look more at the third-party management experience for that specialized housing relative to ownership of the borrower themselves. So with conduit lenders, you're still looking at very competitive terms. You're looking at 75% loan to value. They're still doing a 30-year AM for you. Now, they'll probably dial that back to 25 on a commercial property, but you know, for a newer property, they might go 30, but in general, they're still going to come in at 25. They're going to bottom out on their loan sizes at, say, roughly a couple million dollars. Say $2.5 million to $3 million would be a reasonable floor on your conduit side. There's some players that are getting into the game down below $2 million, but not too many of them. But, you know, again, specialized tenant base, pre-review markets, they can be a real, real viable option. And I would be specific and say larger pre-review markets. You know, maybe something in, you know, one of the major MSAs of Indiana or Ohio. You know, Houston might be a great option for that. So just, you know, Jacksonville, Florida, it's another area where, you know, CMBS loan might be real positive. In general, they're real competitive in those markets. Agencies, once again, they're breaking their programs up in between small balance and you know, your standard DUS program and Freddie Mac conventional. 80% leverage in most states, 30-year amortization is real common. As I said before, that 12 to 15-year fixed is really popular right now. You know, you can look at a 12-year term or a 15-year term with a rate that's just in the high fours, you know, say 4.8, 4.9%. And, you know, these, like we said, these loans are assumable. So if somebody comes in year five, wants to buy that property from you, they're still going to have a 7 to 10 year runway on that loan. And it can be real, real positive, because when they have, as long as you have more than 7 years left, Fannie Mae will oftentimes be able to do some type of secondary financing for you, known as a supplemental loan. So that can be positive. Your conduit lenders won't do it. Freddie Mac conventional will do it. So keep that in mind. It kind of makes the agencies look a little bit more attractive if you're assuming a loan. I'd mentioned before about discounts. And on these small balance programs, you can oftentimes see a discount and on your DUS deals as well, Fannie Mae in general, you know, they're offering the Green Initiatives program where if you can demonstrate up to 25% savings of either water or electrical, they'll offer you up to a 30 basis point discount. And they'll also roll the required recommended improvements to do that into the cost. They will lend on it. So it can be really advantageous. The way that's going to work is at loan application, when you would normally send in your expense deposit of, let's say, $15,000 or so for your third parties, they will also order what's called an HPB report, a high performance building report, and it's an additional $10,000. They'll go in and they'll look at the property condition and see where you can save energy. And they'll give you a list. And they'll say, if you do, you know, this repair that's going to cost $3,500, let's say it's put aerators in the kitchen faucets, and it's going to cost, you know, $1,500 to do it, and you're going to save 2.5% on your electrical. Well, you're going to choose enough of those in one category or the other, water or electrical, that would add up to a 25% savings, and then you can qualify for that. And then if you do choose to move forward with the program, they will refund that $10,000 to you. If you decide not to move forward, then obviously you would eat that cost of the $10,000. But, you know, over the life of the loan and when you're calculating your debt service coverage ratio, a 30 basis point reduction in the rate can really be a help. So that's one of the areas how you can keep that rate down. You know, another advantage too on these small balance programs, when you're presenting a property with 50 units or less, Fannie Mae will also offer a step down prepayment penalty. So just keep that in mind as well to for the smaller deals. Look at that step down prepay with Fannie Mae, because it might be a real savings if you did want to get out early. So both Fannie and Freddie's small balance programs are real competitive, real attractive. You know, lower upfront expenses. Freddie Mac's program, they're really, really attractive. Keep in mind that they're not collecting for insurance reserves. They don't collect for replacement reserves, which obviously it's going to go into the property anyway, but it's nice not to have to spend the money and then wait to get reimbursed. You know, it keeps the money in your pocket and you can execute as needed. So it can be just a little bit easier on the servicing side. We also want to talk about hybrid programs too. When you talk about flexibility of your exit, Freddie Mac offers a 20-year term with various fixed rates. So you could do various fixed periods. So you might do a 5-year fixed period and then a 20-year term where your rate would adjust for the remaining 15 years. You can also do that with a 7-year fixed period and a 13-year adjustment period, and then a 10 and 10. So having that flexibility on your exit can be real attractive. And in some cases, you know, in most cases, there's only about a five basis point increase in your interest rate for that. So it's a real nice insurance policy to have. So that's kind of an overview of where your agencies are right now. Your banks, your credit unions, they're still aggressively going after that smaller business. I mean, they'd like the larger stuff, you know, up to around $3 million or so. But they're a real viable option for the smaller stuff or even light rehabs. I'm actually doing one right now. We're working with a local bank for a rehab deal. Property's sitting right around 70%, and I've got a local bank in the area who's real aggressive, wants that loan. They're looking at just over 5%, 80% loan to value. We're going to do about 18 months of interest only on it until we get it turned around. And I don't mind. I'm okay with the recourse on this one because it's only short term. So these local banks are going to be recourse just about all the time. But it's not permanent debt, so I'm okay with it for the shorter term. That's a real attractive bridge structure right there. Typically, your bridge lenders are going to come in both non-recourse and recourse. They're going to come in. their terms are not as standardized across the U.S. They're a little bit more regional. So you might see some that lend on repairs, some that won't. You have some that will only take on, say, B assets or better. You know, others will take a little bit more risk. They just price up the deals for it. So it's you kind of have to know your lenders on that one, and see what's the right, which lender is going to be the right fit for you, because each one is trying to carve out their own little niche to be competitive. So, you know, some will go into smaller markets. Others will only lend in the major MSAs, and a lot of times they won't stray too far from their home office. You know, some stay regional to the Northwest. Some stay, you know, only in the 212 area code. So knowing your bridge lender is going to be real important. The question you would ask is, you know, you want to know their overall yield. You'd want to know, hey, if their overall yield is 8, well, that's a different type of lender than if their overall yield is 18. You know, the latter is going to go probably 3 or 4 points up front. They're going to have a, you know, 10 to 12% pay rate, but they're probably going to be able to close quickly. They're probably going to do a little bit lighter due diligence on the deal. Your lenders that might take 30 to 45 days, they're going to do a full underwrite, complete three-phase narrative appraisal, and you know, they might only charge 1%, maybe 2% origination, and their pay rate's probably going to be between 6 and 8. So just kind of a couple different types of bridge lenders that you're going to see out there. Some are national. Most, again, are regional, where they kind of stay focused on their own section of the country. But as we started the conversation with, all of them are going to be focused on that exit strategy. All of them are going to want to know how they're going to get paid back. So, you know, make sure that you have that exit strategy in place early on before we start those discussions. Some will even, you know, participate in the equity, but it's on a real case-by-case basis and typically after you've, you know, established a relationship with them. So just to touch on rates a little bit too, and something that you can kind of keep an eye on, as you see, you know, the Dow move, and as you see the general equities markets move in a positive direction, that will typically have a negative impact on our interest rates, meaning our interest rates are typically going to go up. What you're going to see is the equities markets rise, and that will typically drive down bond prices. Well, as bond prices drop, bond yields increase. Our interest rates on our securitized debt for commercial real estate are based on bond yields. So as those bond yields rise, you know, you're going to see our interest rates rise. So for the first quarter of 2018, we've seen, and let's just talking about the 10-year Treasury yield, you know, we've seen about a 40 basis point jump in the Treasury, or 10-year Treasury, since 2018, since January of 2018. So, you know, it started in the roughly 2.45 range in the, you know, the mid-240s, and now we're in the mid-280s. So that's really what you want to watch to get a gauge on those interest rates. You know, big picture, you can really see what's happened over the last year. You know, if you look at the 52-week range of the 10-year Treasury, a year ago, we were right around 2%. We've been up as high as you know, the mid-290s, 2.94, 2.95. So, you know, just to give a gauge on that, you know, we see these Treasury yields run up, and they settle back down a little bit. But when they settle down, typically it's a little bit higher than where it was before. So these defining these new floors is what you're going to see, is how you see these gradual increases. So that's really the general market overview, kind of an idea of what I'm seeing out there and what we're working on. Happy to open it up to any questions or, you know, any more specifics that you like on any of this stuff.
So if you have any questions, that was great stuff, Eric. If anyone has any questions, you know, just press star zero, and that will get you the operator. Rashawn, do we have any questions on the line right now?
Yes, our first question comes from Tom. Tom, please state your question.
Hi, Eric. Thank you so much for all the wonderful information. And we have a situation where we are looking at a loan assumption with a supplemental. Can you just shed some light on how that works and how we can put that into underwriting, especially the loan assumption?
Sure, sure. You know, when you're assuming a loan, it's obviously it's a little bit easier to define your loan terms because you know the rate is already locked and in place and the terms already set. So that's a real plus. The supplemental financing is a bit of a variable because obviously it's strictly up to the lender. The one thing that you can inquire about is if there are any previously defined caps on that leverage. You know, I've got a specific instance where I had a Freddie Mac loan that was capped at 68%. And that was written into the loan docs at origination that any supplemental financing would be capped at 68%. Well, that, you know, that's a material note to really touch on. Now, what you're going to do, obviously, is in your analysis, you're going to look at both of those loans and then you know, define what your blended rate is. Or, I believe Dave's template allows for secondary financing as well. So you can use the secondary financing box of your template and dial them in that way. They are going to be coterminous, so they're going to end at they're going to mature at the same time. And you know it's typically if you have less than 5 years left on your term, you shouldn't expect to get supplemental financing. You know lenders get concerned about levering back up with less than 5 years left. So there's just some notes
okay,
on that.
So thank you, Eric. And just one additional question. So when we are looking into the loan assumption, already probably the loan might have passed 2 to 3 years, right? So we may need to look into the amortization table and skip the initial 2 to 3 years to see how we are going to get the principal reduction and interest, right?
If you're saying the loan has been in place for a couple of years?
Yeah, if the loan is in place for, say, 2 or 3 years, and now we are assuming the loan, so at that point, the principal and interest component of the monthly payment is going to be different, right? So when we are calculating a 5-year or a 6-year return, the principal component that we are going to get is going to be different because the initial 3 years is already paid off.
Well, your payment is going to be the same. The total payment is going to be the same, obviously. That's going to be fixed at closing. You can just look at your amortization schedule, you know, and dial in what the remaining schedule is going to be. But your purchase price is set relative to that loan balance. So, I mean, your template should be the same, just gauging for what that existing loan balance is going to be. Now,
right,
that's one aspect of it. If you're talking about the interest-only period, that's entirely up to that specific structure. I mean, sometimes you can go full IO. I'm analyzing one now that's got a 5-year interest-only period. They've been in the deal for 2 years. So we've got 3 years interest-only left on a 10-year term.
Okay, so now if it is a 3-year loan, I mean 30-year loan, and for 1 year interest only, is it really calculated as 1 plus 30 years, or is it 1 plus 29 years?
Oh, well, your amortization is still going to be 30 years. So they define your payment at closing at 30 years, and
okay.
They're just collecting the interest portion for that first year.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your clarification.
Oh, my pleasure. Call me if I can be of any assistance.
Yeah, sure, Eric.
Any other questions out there?
Next on the line, we have Melvin. Melvin, please state your question.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for the great information.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. I said, sure, no problem. I probably didn't say it loud.
No problem. I'm beginning my apartment investing career, and I've been eyeing a couple of properties, and I want to make an offer, but the seller is asking for proof of funds. So if my money's coming from multiple investors, how do I show proof of funds? How would you handle that situation?
Well, most of the time we're going to let the sellers know that it is going to be syndicated. I mean, that's something you certainly want to be upfront about. So you don't necessarily have those funds in the bank. In most cases, you know, working with a sponsor and leveraging their bio would be sufficient to get that under contract. Now I've seen some real estate brokers recently who have been very, very adamant about, you know, proof of funds and very adamant about qualifying their borrower, but typically it's not that stringent. Now this was, I'm citing one scenario, one recent scenario where it was just, in my opinion, it was overkill. But that being said, we always have to stay cognizant of what these real estate brokers are doing when they accept our contract. You know, they are putting their reputation on the line and saying, hey, this individual is going to close this loan for you, Mr. Seller, or going to close this deal for you, Mr. Seller, so take your property off the market for 90 days and trust that they can do it. So it's real important to start by understanding what they're trying to accomplish and what they're putting on the line by recommending you. And then usually presenting your sponsor's bio, letting them know what deals they've done in the past. That's your partnership team. That's your business better half, so to speak.
Okay.
That's what I see. You know, you're not going to have the money. If you're going to buy if you're going to raise $1 million, you're not going to have $1 million sitting there ready to show unless it's a 1031 exchange.
Right.
I think there are some viable proof of funds options out there too online. I don't know the websites off the top of my head, but I think you can do something like that too for a proof of funds letter. To what capacity, I don't know. What dollar amount, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for that.
Sure.
Next on the line, we have Pranav. Pranav, please go ahead.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for sharing the market outlook and the interest rate outlook. It was very helpful. I had a twofold question. What are the default rates that you're seeing right now, and what's been the trend over the last couple of years?
I haven't really been involved in the default rates just because that's more of a servicing function. So it's tough for me to answer that. In most cases, your default rates are going to be governed by your usury laws. So, I mean, these lenders are going to structure their loan docs so they can get all they can get. Hopefully you won't have to deal with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
There appears to be no further questions at this time.
Okay. Eric, I have a couple of questions that people wrote in to me. So I'm just going to take a couple for you, and then you can answer them that way, okay?
Sure.
All right. So I have one question from Janice McCoy. She writes, Eric, do you always have to put down 20 to 25% of sale price on all loans? And if not, what is the least amount you can put down to secure a loan?
Great question. Obviously, that's a huge portion of your returns is what your acquisition costs are. Standard market equity injection for a stabilized property is going to be 20 to 25%. That's the norm, and that's really what you should plan on. There are some different strategies out there to get higher leverage. What I've found most of the time, and if I make a blanket statement and say it's 100% of the time, then there's going to be some scenario out there where it doesn't. So I will say most of the time, the general rules apply that the higher you go up in the capital stack, the more risk you're taking on. The more risk you take on, the more you're going to be compensated for that risk. So if you are above, say, 85% of that capital stack, meaning all of the funds that you're bringing to the table to pay for that property, well, now you're in equity territory. Now the risk basis for that money is that much higher. I mean, from a debt standpoint, you would be considered over-leveraged for the market. So that higher risk is going to increase your cost of funds or what that money, what they're going to charge for that money. So you're in equity. If you call it debt, that's fine, but you're still going to get higher price debt at that leverage. So I would venture to say that putting the energies into getting a good deal done in conventional market territory would be more productive than, you know, tracking the unknown of 95 or 90% 90% leverage and trying to figure out how someone's going to put that together for you, probably putting up some money for them to figure it out, and then potentially losing that expense deposit. That would be my concern. Going with a proven market strategy is I have to recommend that over, you know, trying some new strategy that you're not familiar with. If you've got somebody that's done it before and they're willing to jump in with you, different story altogether. But if it's a complete unknown, I would caution you against that. That being said, yes, 20 to 25% equity injection should be considered standard for the multifamily market.
Thank you. And I do have another one. This one's from Yanni. Yanni writes, how do I help my client borrow private money for bridge loans?
Well, I guess it all depends on who the relationship that you have with the bridge lender. I've got some bridge money out there that I'd be happy to help you with. I do work with some brokers and co-broker deals, so feel free to give me a call and we can certainly talk through the strategy. Every deal is, you know, every deal that requires bridge financing has some quirky reason why we're not going perm. So it's something we want to kind of dig into and talk through.
Eric, can you give out your contact information so people can write it down?
Yeah, absolutely. My phone number is 1-800-916-9005, and my email address is estewart, so estewart@atlanticbusinesscapital.com.
Perfect. And don't worry, if you didn't get it, he'll say it at the end. So, Rashawn, any other questions? She's probably taking one now.
Oh, okay.
And I would ask a question, but none of them are short.
Oh.
So let me just go to this one really quick. This is from Phil and Victoria Russo. Can you please provide some guidance and direction on the underwriting template relating to assuming a property? When looking at whether to get into an assumption deal and the underwriting template, I went through the initial acquisition tab and entered all the relevant information. This is basically about the assumption tab, but can you just explain assumption loans to people that are out there so that way they can understand how that works for us, Eric?
Yeah. Absolutely, I'd be happy to. We do offer assumption representation, so you know you don't have to go directly to the lender on those assumptions. Now, you do go back through, and this is how the process starts: is you do go back through the originating lender, you know, so whoever did the loan first, that's who you're going to go back through. But I do offer that, so you can connect with me on it, and we can kind of walk through the process, and I'm happy to represent you. Essentially, you're going to assume an existing loan for a couple reasons. One is that there may be a very expensive prepayment penalty on the loan that's hindering the sale of the property, where it just doesn't make sense for the seller to pay it and get rid of the property. So, you know, taking over the payments on that existing loan would avoid that. Or, you know, a lot of times in a rising interest rate environment like this, you might see a really attractive structure that you want to jump in on. And if there's a reasonable runway on that, then it it could be very advantageous. So there's a couple reasons why you want to assume the loan. And there's some nuances to assuming a loan that are different than putting new money on it. You know, going in and assuming the debt is not just qualifying for the loan as though you were originating it. They're also comparing you to the existing borrower. So, you know, if you, let's say you're assuming a loan from an institution that's really, really liquid and you know, has a ton of money behind them, you know, you're going to come in there and say, well, why are they going to let me take over this loan when, you know, they've got, you know, BlackRock on the note right now? Well, the reality is there's a number of different reasons why or how you can establish value as a new borrower relative to an existing borrower. Clearly, if they want to sell the property, there's a reason why they're looking to get out of that asset. And a lot of times, I've seen this, these are live examples that I'm talking about, a lot of times there may be an investment firm that is divesting from a certain market. Maybe they're getting out of that specific asset class altogether, in which case, in either case, they're demonstrating a lack of interest in that asset. And, I've seen some borrowers that just didn't get along with that specific city council or the city officials. There could be a number of reasons why, but for whatever reason, there's a lack of interest in that property, and there's a desire to not be involved with it anymore. And you, as a new borrower coming in, bringing equity to the table, injecting new ideas and a fresh outlook on the success of that asset, that's really attractive to a lender. So presenting that, wanting to increase your footprint in the market, demonstrating what you're going to do and how you're going to bring that asset to the next level or at least back up where it should be, that can be a real, real positive note when you're presenting for that assumption. So, essentially, what you're going to do is once you lock down your purchase contract, you're going to have to have the seller put in the request for the assumption application before they'll even talk to you. You've got to have the seller authorize it and make a formal request for the assumption docs. And then the underwriting firm that originally closed the loan will send those documents out to you. And, you know, essentially you get the ball rolling. If it's a recently closed loan, you know, maybe it's just a couple years, you're just a couple years into the deal, a lot of times they can just bump up the existing reports. In most cases, you're going to be expected to put that 1% up, because there's usually a 1% assumption fee. You're going to be expected to put about 1% up as a deposit. They don't always have to order new reports, but if you've been in the loan a couple years or more, they're at least going to have to update them. But in most cases, they've already got a pretty good handle on the property performance, and they're just going to want to underwrite you and the borrowing team. Standard would be financial statements, resumes, credit authorization, your organizational chart of your company so they can see what the ownership breakdown is. They're going to have to prove liquidity. So any liquid funds on your personal financial statement are going to have to be backed up by bank statements of where they're held. And then also the management company. If you're going to change management companies, they're going to have to come in and you know, review their history and their resume as well. So that's going to be another component. A lot of times the assumptions are known for taking longer, but they've been speeding up. They've been the process has been a lot better lately because we've seen more and more assumptions because of rising interest rates. So people taking the securitized debt, wanting to sell, wanting to capitalize on rising prices, and offering lower rates. It's assumptions are more and more popular now. So that's kind of an overview of how it's going to work.
And Victoria or Phil, if you guys need help with the assumption template, let me know, and I'll definitely be happy to help you guys with that, to fill that out for you. Any questions, operator?
Yes. Up next, we have Bob. Bob, please state your question.
Hello, Eric. My partner, Walt, and I met you in Boston at the Private Money seminar, and it was great to meet you, and thank you for what you bring to the table here for us. I don't have a specific question, but I just wanted to make sure you touched on the topics on Jermaine's list, in particular, what lenders are looking for in a sponsor, and also a little bit on recourse and non-recourse loans, and maybe what bad boy clauses is.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the note. It was great to see you guys at that Private Money event. It was a really good event. Great turnout. A lot of good info. Enjoyed seeing some old friends and meeting new faces there. So I'm excited for the next one. As far as what lenders look for from a key principle, they have three areas that they really focus on. They look at your net worth, they look at your liquidity, and they look at your experience. For this securitized debt, they really don't focus on your income as much. But that net worth, this is cumulative of the whole team. They want to see that your net worth is at least what the loan amount is. And this is in that's $1 to $10 million range. They want to see that your net worth is at least what the loan amount is. They want to see that your post-closing liquidity, or cash equivalents after the loan closes, this is a gray area, right? There's your minimums, which is about a year's worth of payments. Some lenders just 9 months worth of payments. Those are the minimums. Then there's what they really want, and that is if a lender was creating their own avatar, they would want to come in with at least 10% of the requested loan amount. And then anything above that really becomes a mitigating factor. So if there's something soft in the deal, they might say, yeah, but there's good liquidity. And then they want to see that we've got some experience under our belt. And that, again, is much more of a recipe than it is a formula where it's not an exact science. If the financials are strong, the property's doing well, and you've got some commercial experience in the area or maybe some healthy amount of single family experience in the area, and you're going to have a solid third-party manager in there, well, we can always make exceptions on that. If you intend on self-managing, that's a different ballgame. Then they have some specific guidelines where they really want you within 100 miles. Fannie Mae wants to see that you've owned like property for a couple years, that type of thing. So self-managing is a lot more strict. Third-party management really does help, but they still want to see some type of commercial real estate experience in your history. And ideally, they want to see that you've got some multifamily. So it's kind of the general range of that one. Now, signing on the loan or being underwritten, they can mean a couple different things. And on your small balance deals, it's typically a 50% ownership threshold that's going to trigger that. On your larger deals, your DUS deals, say 5 million plus, that threshold is usually 25%. So when we say that someone is a key principal, that typically means they either have a manager's position in the LLC or they own more than one of those thresholds, either 25 or 50%. And that would typically trigger, one, that they're being searched. So the lender's going to go through and make sure you're not a terrorist, make sure you're not laundering money, that type of thing. And they're also going to ask that you sign on the loan as a key principal. Now, when we talk about non-recourse debt, you're talking about the type of debt that is not qualified, not looking for you to personally guarantee it. It's just a corporate guarantee. But there are certain provisions or certain instances where that lender can come after you personally. And so what you were referring to, Bob, was called carve-outs, or as you said, bad boy clauses. And it essentially focuses around criminal activity, negligence, abandonment, embezzlement, things like that, things where you are intentionally doing harm to the property or intentionally defrauding the bank in some way, or effectively not cooperating with them. And I'll give you a couple examples just to make references to. A common carve-out is an environmental carve-out. If you were to intentionally harm the property or through your own negligence harm the property from an environmental standpoint, they have the right to come after you personally. If you embezzle funds, if you redirect capital, say once you're in special servicing, if you intentionally redirect capital, they can come after you personally. And when I say redirect, you know, I mean put money in your own pocket, in disguising the flow of funds in a way where you're putting money in your own pocket rather than making your mortgage payment. That would be something they can come after you personally on. If you were to, let's say you file voluntary bankruptcy just to delay or shield yourself against communicating with the bank or the lender, that is another area where they can come after you personally. And that's a common statement that a lender is going to make is, you know, who's signing on my carve-outs? Who's the warm body that's going to stand up for these things to say they're not going to do that? You know, they don't plan on coming after you personally for this stuff, for deficiency judgment, but they do want to know the financial strength, the history, and the liquidity of the person that is or the warm body that's actually signing on those carve-outs. So that's kind of an overview of what they look for.
Okay, great stuff. A quick follow-up. Do I have time on the sponsor? So we're new at this, so excuse me, forgive me if I'm asking some silly questions, but a sponsor is someone that signs a loan in our behalf because we wouldn't qualify for the loan on our own. Is that correct?
There's a couple different, I would say there's a couple different uses of the term sponsor, and it kind of depends on where you're sitting. So when you talk about a sponsor, when you use the term sponsor, you are referring to someone that is coming in the capacity that you just said. And that makes perfect sense. To the big picture answer would just be yes, you're right. However, there's a lot more to it that I think it's important to understand, and I think it's important to look at the definition of a sponsor from a lender's position, and I think it'll help kind of round things out for you. First, this sponsor that you're referring to is essentially a partner of yours. So they are going to be in the deal, they're going to be making decisions in the deal because, again, they're on the hook for the loan, so they're going to have a say in what goes on. It's not a scenario where, you know, it's the equivalent of, you know, you signing for your kid's first car and you just have your fingers crossed that they're going to make the payment, because we've all heard that story before, right? This is a scenario where you've got an active owner-operator that's got the experience or financial wherewithal to go in and not just get the sign to get the loan approved and then walk away, but offer their expertise and guidance and participation to for the success of that asset. That is what their real position is. That's the nuts and bolts of what they're doing. We've got to take a step back and consider that your lender is essentially a partner with you as well. I mean, they want the success of this asset just like you want the success of the asset, right? So the requirements that they implement are to as best they can ensure that. So they want to see the same thing you want to see. So that the sponsor that they're looking for helps them and it helps you. This person comes in and their value is well beyond just getting a loan approved. Their value is really seeing a successful operation go through. So, you know, whatever type of, you know, equity agreement you would put together, ownership or fee agreement you put together with them, you know, for your first couple deals, when you get the right sponsor and have that right relationship, that's money well spent. So they are more of a partner and an involved partner rather than just a, you know, sign and drive sponsor. That would be the first thing that I would like to convey to you. The second level of this is when a lender refuses the term sponsor, they're referring to anybody signing on the loan. And I think that kind of helps put it in perspective as well, is if, you know, the lender's saying, the same way I said before, they want to know who's signing on my carve-outs, well, another term that you're going to hear is, who are my sponsors? Meaning, if you sign on that loan, even if it's your first deal, as long as you're clean credit and there's no derogatories in your history, you can certainly sign on the loan to help build that relationship. You're a sponsor in the lender's eyes because you are sponsoring the deal. You are signing on the loan, signing on the carve-outs, standing up for the success of that asset. So just to kind of put it in perspective and summarize, your sponsor is an active partner in the deal, not just a sign and drive, get the loan approved individual. And then secondly, from a lender's standpoint, anybody that signs in the carve-outs is considered a sponsor.
So, okay, great information. We can't just go to our rich uncle who has absolutely no experience in this kind of thing and have them come in and be the main signer on a loan to help us get into a deal.
I don't want to say you can't, because I don't know the specific scenario or the background of that uncle, and there's always another option there where you go to that rich uncle who's got the strong balance sheet. Maybe we go to a different lender to get that done. You know, maybe that rich uncle happens to live in the same market as where the asset is. You know, that can go a long way as well. So we can always sit here and paint a picture where a deal will work or will not work. The reality is we've got to look at each deal on its own merits and, you know, get you the best debt structure that we possibly can based on the nuances of that opportunity.
Great. Thanks, Eric. And thanks, Jermaine.
Welcome.
Okay, up next we have Joe. Joe, please state your question.
Hi, Eric. I've got two quick questions. One is, and they're related to what you talked before about the current market. In looking at my underwriting template, I've got a space for a percent down and interest rate. What would you put in those so that I could have the correct underwriting template in looking at deals today?
Those two items are going to be based on your specific market. And that's usually something that I would go over during an initial consultation that I like to have with everybody, just to kind of go over the dollar size of the assets you're looking for, the dollar range, where you're looking, how you're raising equity, what your plans are, you know, as far as sponsorship goes. Now, going back to what we were talking about before, market equity injections for a stabilized property are anywhere from 20 to 25%. If you know, you put a gun to my head, and that's always the response, right? Is yeah, but if you had to, if you had to put an answer, what would you put? Well, I would have to default to 25%, only because it's a conservative guesstimate, but at the same time, it's assuming a stabilized property that can go perm debt right away. So the safe answer would be 75%. In many, many markets, we're going to be able to do 80% leverage and a 20% equity injection. But until you and I sit down and kind of talk about your strategy, what you're buying and where you're buying, I'm going to have to default to 75.
And then on the interest rate, is that going to be dependent upon the market as well? I thought that would be a more national rate.
Yes, it's more national, but there are loan-specific characteristics that are going to modify that rate as well. Things like fixed period, you know, how long you're going to fix your rate for. Things like your prepayment penalty, which can have a dramatic impact on your interest rate. Loan size. Loan size can impact your interest rate, or at least define what lender you're going to go to as well. So if once again, we've got to just, what does Pauly say in the Rocky movies? Hit the one in the middle. I would just have to default to 5% at this point. You know, I've seen some quotes come in at 5.15 to 5.2. I've also seen, you know, 4.65 on recent quotes. So in that respect, I would have to say go with a 5% underwrite and plan on your first year interest only. I've got some programs that'll do 3 years interest only, because that's another part of the underwriting template that's going to be a question once you get into it. How many years interest only can I get? And just for kicks, play with a 30-year AM and then put 250 in there and watch what it does to your cash on cash returns. You're going to see a 1.5 to 2% bump in cash on cash returns to investors. It's going to be great. So in most cases, we can do 1 year interest only at a minimum. Depending on your fixed period, we may be able to do up to 3 years without cutting leverage. If you wanted to take a leverage cut, you know, maybe to drop down to 65%, we can do full term IO. So there's some variables there. That's why we want to do that initial consultation and kind of get things lined out in the beginning.
Got it. All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Our last question comes from Gene. Gene, please state your question.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Jermaine. Eric, this is great stuff. I've got three quick questions. I'm looking at a 12-unit and 18-unit. Just a few blocks down from my duplex. The first question I've got is I want to make sure I heard you correctly. On the small biz loan, Fannie Mae limit is $3 million. Is that correct?
Fannie Mae will go down to one. The floor is technically $750,000. Is their technical floor. Most lenders are gonna bottom out at $1 million. They really don't want to do those. They really don't want to do the deals below $1 million. Freddie Mac won't go below $1 million. Their bottom is $1 million. There's maybe one or two lenders for an easy, you know, don't touch it very much deal. They might go down to $750,000, but it's not the norm.
Got it. Okay. And on the Fannie Mae product or Freddie Mac product, what is how much seller financing is allowed? Just so I know how to structure this deal. None. Okay.
Yeah, they don't allow for it.
So if I'm able to get seller financing, then we'd have to look at a different product?
Or see if they'll take an equity position rather than a debt position.
Okay.
And yeah, where you don't have defined, you don't have a maybe you don't set up a promissory note with a defined payment schedule, but you may have your collateral be an equity piece in the deal, which would be considered some type of mezzanine debt. That might be an option for you.
Okay. I'll take it offline with you, more about details on that. The third one is the combining. So on the 12-unit, 18-unit, these are two separate deals. The numbers are pretty good. They're hitting the trilogies. So as far as do I finance both of them at the same time? Strategic-wise, what's the best approach?
How much are they combined or individually?
Combined, we're looking at about just under 3.
Okay. So, I mean, is the per unit value basically the same?
Yes. About $65K per door, which I think there's room to negotiate.
Okay. Yeah, so it's going to depend on how far apart they are.
On the corner from each other.
But they're not contiguous.
No, they're not. So it's two different sellers that are selling.
Oh, two different sellers. Okay. That's gonna be a little bit more complicated. If they were run together, you know, like if it's Camelot Arms 1 or Camelot Arms East, Camelot Arms West, that kind of thing. That's an easier sell for non-contiguous assets like this. Two different sellers, two different properties around the corner from each other. That's something we should talk about offline again, because it's going to be a little bit more detailed to get those done.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
So, Eric, that was the last call. We really do appreciate you taking your time to address the students. If anybody wants to reach you, how can they do that again?
Oh, thanks. It's you can call me at 1-800-916-9005, or you can email me at estewart@atlanticbusinesscapital.com. And feel free to visit the website as well. It's atlanticbusinesscapital.com.
All right. Well, Eric, once again, thank you very much. Everyone else, have a good weekend, and happy hunting, guys. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Jermaine. Take care.
You're welcome.